Indeed, and tonight our special guest, Ian Lawton, as we talk about reincarnation and the soul, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. A degree in economics, then in his mid-30s, he left the commercial world to become a full-time writer-researcher, specializing in ancient history and spiritual philosophy. He's the author of a number of books, which include The Book of the Soul, where he first developed the idea of rational spirituality, in addition to establishing himself as one of the world's leading authorities on the interlife. This was followed by The Wisdom of the Soul and The Little Book of the Soul. And Ian, you were with me, if I recall, a little bit more than 5 years ago on the air here. How are you?
I think that's right.
Yeah, why have you been away so long?
Because your producer's very busy, George. That's why.
That's true. Well, I'm glad we found you again, Ian. How have you been?
I've been very well, thank you. Yes, very well. It's 7 o'clock in the morning over here, so it's I'm a little bit blurry, but I'm sure I'll wake up shortly.
Oh, and you know what? And by the end of the program, it'll be 10 o'clock in the morning your time. So you'll
be okay. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, several years ago, when you were on the program, we talked a lot about the pyramids of Giza.
Yep.
Fascinating. Today, they released they showed the mummified head of King Tut today.
Yes, I gathered, and apparently he had buck teeth. I saw here on the radio.
Yeah, he sure did. And they've ruled out that he was murdered. They probably think he just died of infection or something like that at the age of 19 years old.
So that's another conspiracy down the pan.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't it amazing what science can do these days?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's, and I guess actually that's a lot of what I'm trying to do these days now is we've spent many thousands of years with our religions and our spiritual approaches being based on, should we say, revealed wisdom of prophets and gurus and people of that nature. And I just think that the beginning of the 21st century, it's time to use the considerable research skills that we have in a variety of different fields and pull all of that research together and have an approach to spirituality that, as you said earlier, you know, I refer to it as rational spirituality. It's based on modern evidence and analysis of modern evidence. The two tie in, really.
The rational spirituality is not based on faith or belief, is it?
No, absolutely not. I'm really trying to get away from all of that, you know, and whenever I talk to people about the fact that I do spiritual writing these days, they say, so what, do you believe in reincarnation? And I say, no, I don't use the word belief. What I'm suggesting is that I think there's very good evidence for it, and it's the most logical analysis of the evidence.
You know, when we look at evidence, and that's one of the problems that science has had, and that's trying to find evidence to convince people that there's something scientific going on with the afterlife.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you mean by evidence-based, then.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you what I don't mean by evidence-based.
All right.
The sort of things that I don't tend to bring into the rational spiritual approach are the work of mediums and investigations into telepathy and telekinesis and things like that. Not for one moment, because I think that there isn't some substance and basis to those areas of research, but also we all know that there are sometimes people who are being having less than full integrity working in those areas sometimes. And they are easy targets for skeptics. People like James Randi and people like that can easily have a go at people who are trying to claim mediumship abilities or telepathy and so on and so forth. So for me, I tend to try and avoid those. And I think the three really strong areas of research for a modern rational spiritual approach are, first of all, research into near-death experiences.
Okay.
Secondly, into children who seem to have spontaneous memories of past lives. And thirdly, into regression research into past lives. And I think those three together have some very, very strong, there's some very strong case studies in there. And in particular, what I tend to concentrate on is the fact that in all three areas of research, there are cases involving what I call obscure and verifiable evidence, which I would suggest makes the any other than a paranormal explanation extremely unlikely and not the most logical analysis. That's the key point.
Okay, let's go through each one of these areas at depth if we can. We've got lots to talk with you about tonight. But near-death experience, of course, according to you, might be what?
Well, the key thing I'm interested in here are the cases of near-death experience where people have either been very close to death or have actually physically died for a period of time. And then when they come back, I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with the idea that we have this consistent theme of sometimes talking about a tunnel or at least a very bright light that they encounter, and then encountering other beings of maybe friends or family, deceased friends or family, or sometimes somebody that I identify as a religious or spiritual figure. And they get this great sense of warmth and love. And but, you know, to cut a long story short, they are effectively, they describe a barrier that they can't go through. Or I guess it's a psychological barrier, really. And they're effectively, it's communicated to them one way or another that they have to come back, that it's not their time to move into the light, as it were. Now, that's all very well, but what I'm most interested in here is when they have what we call veridical elements to their experience, and that is they remember things while they were, well, maybe not clinically dead, but certainly right, completely unconscious, that can be verified afterwards. And I think that's when we have to start saying there's something going on here that cannot just be accounted for by suggestions of physical brain usage and normal physical mechanisms.
And what I find fascinating about this, Ian, is so many people who have had these experiences all have similar experiences.
Yes,
it's, they do. It's not like they come back with a zillion different stories.
No, although what I would say about that is, of course, and this is a theme that we'll encounter again later on, I'm sure, in this talk, the people who had the original experiences, I think the fact that those were common, that their reports were common, is a very important issue. Of course, now, since Raymond Moody's book came out in the mid-70s, Life After Life, that became pretty well known, and I think, you know, it's quite easy for skeptics to say, well, hang on a minute, look, you know, the theme of this going into the light, being met by relatives and whatever, that's a very common theme. Everybody knows about it now because of the books, etc. And so I think probably now the evidence is weakened because it is so well known. But originally, the key point is, originally it wasn't well known and people were still saying the same things.
You know, in all these stories that you hear, it's kind of funny, and the older we get, the more we are tuned into stories about people who have died, how they've died. This weekend, you know, an Olympic runner, 28 years old, drops dead. Father claims that he had an enlarged heart, you know, he kept pushing himself in training. But, I mean, it really is a question of our own mortality.
Yes.
When you see things like that, and you have to believe, or it's even frighteningly so, if you don't believe that there's an afterlife.
Well, again, you see the key skeptics like Richard Dawkins. I don't know how is he well known? I'm sure he is well known over there in the U.S.
Yes,
certainly well known over here. They have a field day with arguments like that, with respect, because of course they suggest that any kind of religious or spiritual belief, and I use the word belief advisedly there, is just a need to believe because we're too scared to conceive of anything else. And of course, what I'm saying is that's nothing of the sort. With the approach that I'm discussing here with rational spirituality, it's not a need to believe at all. It's because it's the most sensible and rational analysis of the evidence that's now on the table. Of course, the fact that it, you know, that the sort of framework that comes out of that evidence is arguably gives us a great deal of comfort and hope and gives us some meaning and purpose to life is not the key point behind it. It's, you know, and so, but again, I say it's evidence, not faith, and it's not a need to believe either. And I think that's important.
Let's move on to children who remember past lives.
Yeah.
How prevalent is this?
Well, as far as I'm aware, you may have had some discussions in recent months, perhaps on the show, about these children who remember past lives, and the pioneering evidence research was mainly done by Dr. Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, who I'm sure many of your listeners will have heard of. Is this something you've talked about recently,
Jordan? Yes, not recently, but we have talked about it.
Okay. just to recap quickly, Stevenson started his work in the late 50s, early 60s, and managed to build up a department at the university which specialized in this investigation of children who were having spontaneous memories of past lives. They would just start talking about past lives when they were very young, and usually more or less when they could only just begin to speak. And he built up a team, and over the 60s and 70s, right through to the modern day, that team has grown, and I believe they've got something like over 3,000 cases on file. Stevenson's, this is pioneering research that it is, I think, is a hugely important prop in the what I call a rational spiritual approach.
Yes.
Again, the key factor about this is that you've got many, many cases where children are remembering specific details of past lives that are very obscure, and again, they can be verified one way or another. So, whereas a lot of skeptics would tend to try and write these things off as just, oh, this is just purely anecdotal. That's just not a sensible, logical explanation anymore. And in fact, as much as I don't want to be unduly combative about this, we do find that with the main skeptics with all of these areas of research, that they really don't tend to do their work very thoroughly. They will write things off in a very simplistic and reductionist way. And they seem to display very, very little knowledge of the detail of the cases on file. So, and as I say, there are several thousand of these cases put together by Stevenson and his department. Unfortunately, Stevenson himself died. I think it was earlier this year, after all his fantastic work.
Mm-hmm.
But his department has now been taken over by Jim Tucker, who's carrying on that terrific work. And, there are specific cases, which we can talk about if we have time,
that
have very important elements to them.
You know, and it's fascinating, too, with researchers who pass on, who die.
Yeah.
I wonder, Ian, if one of the first things they say to themselves on the other side is, I knew this was right, you know?
I'm even more interested when somebody like Richard Dawkins dies, is he going to say, I was wrong all the way?
I was wrong. past life regression research.
Yep.
What about that?
Yeah, now this is an interesting one because the more work I've done on this over the years, and even some work that I've done recently, I've had to change my opinion slightly. This past life regression research is when usually using hypnosis, but there are other mechanisms as well for putting people into a trance state, and usually as adults, obviously, and getting them to come up with details of previous lives. And this is an area that is often dismissed, even by non-skeptics. And certainly, Ian Stevenson himself, for example, would not, right throughout his life and even to the end, he would not accept past life regression research as sensible evidence for reincarnation. And in fact, I tried to say to him that, look, we've got past life regression cases that contain exactly the same sort of obscure and verifiable evidence that you're coming up with children who have spontaneous past life memories. And for that reason, it would be ridiculous to suggest that all past life memories evoked by regression are fully accurate and historically reliable. Nevertheless, we have got some cases that again, have this obscure and verified evidence that I think are just too strong to be dismissed out of hand.
You know, there is a common theme here, too, of these cases, right?
Yeah.
And the common denominator happens to be that these past lives go on over and over and over again. Very rarely is a past life person who has been regressed, very rarely is it like one life. It's numerous lives.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, the vast majority of us appear to have been around for some considerable time, and we're still coming back. That, of course, leads us on to the question of why are we doing it, but I'm sure we'll get to that later on. But yes, you very rarely have only one or two lives and nothing else. And most people, of course, can have these memories, too, is another interesting factor of it. It's that, this is not about people who are particularly susceptible. Most people, when regressed, will come up with something. And again, you know, it's easy for skeptics to say, well, yeah, that's because the human brain is an incredible tool and has incredible imagination. But again, I reiterate that that cannot account for those cases where we have this very obscure and verifiable evidence.
Ian, how did you get involved in all this?
Well, that's a story in itself. It was when you and I last spoke, as we said, we were talking about the pyramids in Egypt, weren't we?
Right.
And then I then went on to write a second book that was called Genesis Unveiled, where I was researching. That was my take, really, on all of the, shall we say, the Atlantis-style myths and traditions that are from all around the globe. And what I tried to do was to pull all of those traditions together and try and see what were the common elements about this very, you know, the supposedly very early history of mankind. And the conclusion that I came to was that there probably was a very sophisticated civilization that was wiped out by a massive catastrophe, you know, the flood, as it's often called in biblical terms or whatever, probably around about 11,500 years ago, something of that order. There seems to be a lot of geological evidence for that. But my interpretation was not so much the the one that is often adopted by alternative authors, which is that, you know, this is all to do with high technology and et cetera, et cetera. My view, my reading of the traditions was very much the common element was that these were people who were very spiritually aware. That was the key thing about them, much more so than anything to do with technology or anything like that. And that message comes out again and again in traditions from all around the world. And so I tried to put that, excuse me, into a spiritual framework, which included the concept of reincarnation. And my publishers at the time, Virgin, when I submitted the manuscript to them, said, well, this is all very well, but you're not actually talking very much about the modern evidence that you suggest is there to have this spiritual worldview. Can you put a new chapter in? And that's what I did. I had to do a whole load of new research to pull that together for them to go into an early part of the book, and that's really where this came from.
Ian, do you find that modern science is doing a thorough job researching this, or they just don't care?
Oh, well, there's plenty of people who do care and doing a fantastic job, and people like Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia would be one. There are a great many, when we're talking about past life and even life between lives regression, again, we'll come on to that later on, there are, have been many pioneers working in those fields for the last 30 or 40 years. And again, these people, they're not quacks. They're not New Age idiots. These are professionally trained psychologists and psychiatrists, most of whom had an atheist viewpoint, certainly when they were studying, and had to move away from that just because of the evidence of their own eyes when they were doing this work in their practices. And that's a very common theme. So there are many, many people with, you know, I mean, we can argue all day about what constitutes a genuinely scientific background, but, you know, trained psychologists and psychiatrists are not idiots. They do a formal academic training just as many scientists do. Now, you know, as far as mainstream science is concerned, well, of course, we're still waiting for them to do more in terms of coming towards a more metaphysical viewpoint. But again, plenty of them are doing, there's encouraging signs. I don't find it useful to write off the scientific community as a whole and just go, they're not interested in this stuff.
See, I want to see someone win a Nobel Prize for something like this.
Well, it will happen. I'm convinced it will happen. It just, these things take time, don't they?
Well, yeah, they sure do. Ian, your website, would you get that out before we take this quick break, please?
Yeah, it's www.ianlawton.com.
L-A-W-T-O-N.
Yeah.
And we're talking about reincarnation, near-death experiences. We'll get into the children who remember these past lives. We'll get into all this in greater depth a little bit later on. We'll open up the phone lines for you as well with our very special guest this Sunday and the Monday morning, Ian Lawton. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Bud Hopkins joins us, expert in the alien abduction phenomenon. He just gave a wide-ranging talk based on his files covering 32 years of research into these mysteries, and he's going to talk about it right here on Coast to Coast AM. He's also going to talk about speculation about the fate of the still-missing Daredevil pilot, Steve Fawcett. So I'm looking forward to that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Ian Lawton, our guest. Ian, let's talk about past life regression for a bit and some cases, celebrated cases, if you would. In some of your research, what have you come across?
To go back to the beginning with this stuff, I guess the case that people remember most is involved a lady called Virginia Tighe, who seemed to remember the life of a young Irish girl called Bridie Murphy. That's the first real major case that came to light in the 50s that blew all this stuff up. And that case polarized opinion, and an awful lot of work actually was done to investigate it. And I've looked at a lot of that, but I can't say I'm an expert on it. But all I can say is that it does look very much as if their investigators were able to find out that, in actual fact, this lady had, as a child, had a neighbour who was Irish. I've got an idea, she might even have been called Bridie Murphy herself. But anyway, all the songs that this girl knew and a lot of the information she came up with supposedly had come from this childhood acquaintance. And so it looks as if that's not a particularly strong case, and that it can be explained by what they refer to as cryptomnesia. In other words, memories that were normally acquired sometimes in childhood, and that basically the subject has forgotten about ever having acquired those memories, and therefore when they come out with stuff under hypnosis, it sounds as if it's a genuine past life, but in fact it isn't. So the Bridie Murphy case is probably not a strong one. The next set of cases that came up were in the late 60s, over here in Wales, in fact, in the United Kingdom, and a quite elderly past life regression therapist called Arnold Bloxham. And a BBC radio producer called Geoffrey Everson, who was pretty much a skeptic himself, for one reason or another went down to interview Bloxham and became so impressed by what he found in Bloxham's tapes, etc., that he decided to make a television documentary featuring one of Bloxham's main, most impressive subjects. It was a lady called, they gave her the pseudonym Jane Evans, although that wasn't her real name. And Jane Evans had had a number of different regressions with Bloxham, four or five different lives that really stood out. One in particular, a life as a persecuted Jewess in 11th century York in the north of England. Another one as the wife of a tutor to a fairly senior Roman official in Roman Britain. And another one as a sort of a maidservant, possibly stroke lover, to Jacques Coeur, who was the in the Middle Ages, in Middle Age France. He was a very, very wealthy financier, and supposedly the second most powerful person in the country. Anyway, with all three of these regressions, she was coming up with very, very certainly a lot of detail, but also what Everson thought was pretty obscure detail. And certainly if you read the cases, as I did, you think, well, this is pretty impressive. And Everson wrote a book about this as well as doing a documentary, and he talks about all of the different conventional sources that could have been used. You know, the sort of the only places where some of this information was available. And, you know, builds a very strong case to suggest that, you know, that this woman really, it's the chances of her having read all of these different obscure sources for these different lives are very, very remote. And I myself was pretty much convinced that this must be a very strong set of cases until very recently, when I was doing a little bit more digging. And in fact, if I can just make a quick plug, the reason I was doing some digging was to write a new little book called The Little Book of the Soul. Which I've just released, this is not a commercial advert, because I'm releasing the book as a not-for-profit exercise, which is obviously quite a rare thing.
That is rare.
And so I'm through my website, I'm selling these little books of the soul for eight of them at £10 for eight. And the idea is that people, if they like the book, should pass it on and give it as a gift. And especially with the festive season coming up, I'm hoping that I can really get things moving with that to try and give people more information about this rational spiritual approach. And it's a nice, easy little book to read. I've had a lot of feedback from lots of people who've helped me with putting it together. It's got all of these stories that I'm talking about in it, and it's a nice and readable book with a bit of analysis to pull it together. So I'm hoping that people will be interested in that in the run-up to the festive season. And so that's The Little Book of the Soul, and it's available from www.ianlawton.com and not-for-profit. Anyway, sorry for the diversion, but the reason to mention that is that I was doing a little bit more research just to really try and make sure I was comfortable with what was going into this little book of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered a couple of sources on the internet when you look up things like these Arnold, the Jane Evans case with Arnold Bloxham on the internet, you find the same sort of couple of paragraphs of information that's been copied and put onto loads and loads and loads of different sites. But every now and then, you see an extra little bit of information that gives you a clue that maybe something else was going on. And finally, by tracing all of these slightly more rarer little bits of information, it led me to a couple of books written by skeptics, basically, who'd had a look much more closely at the Bloxham case. And this isn't very well documented on the internet, which, you know, I find that quite surprising, but it really isn't. So there's an awful lot of people who still think these are strong cases. But in actual fact, and it's fascinating, what somebody was able to do was to establish that the sources of cryptomnesia for this lady Jane Evans' recall for these lives was not from any non-fiction books, which is what we naturally would tend to assume that is where the information would have to have come from, but it was from fictional books. There's one particular fictional book about the Roman life where the lead character, who's called Livonia, I think if my memory serves me correct, and all of the names of the other lead characters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are all identical to this fictional book, which I forget the name of it, but it was written in the 1950s sometimes, just as a novel. And it would appear that this lady must have read this novel, on the face of it at least, completely forgotten she'd ever read it. And then all these details were coming out again under trance, but it wasn't a genuine past life at all. It was just her own imagination.
And in the trance state, she basically felt that these were her past lives.
Correct, or at least that's how it was interpreted, but in actual fact, it wasn't. So, you know, the reason for saying this is because I like to try and produce a fairly balanced approach with this rational spirituality, and I think it's very important to make sure you look at all sides of everything, and
How do we know then that all past life regressions aren't this kind of thing?
Well, because I have other cases, and the strongest cases I think that are on record come from a psychologist called Peter Ramster, an Australian called Peter Ramster, who wrote a couple of books, and more importantly than that, produced a fantastic documentary back in the 1970s and early 80s. And he has two or three cases that he wrote about and that are covered by this documentary that are absolutely startling, and that I don't think any of these explanations, including even fictional sources, could hold water to try and explain them.
Well, I got to tell you, this is the first time I've ever heard of cryptoamnesia.
Yeah.
And,
you see, my view of this stuff is that if we can show that we're taking the skeptical analysis of all these areas of research seriously, and where they've got important things to say that suggest that some of these areas of research or particular cases aren't very strong, then of course we should recognize that. I mean, that's the only way you do proper research and have proper scholarship. But if you've still got other cases that you feel they're not explaining properly at all, then I think that just makes our body of evidence that much stronger in saying, look, you can't just dismiss all of this stuff. Some of it maybe, not all of it.
Tell me, though, with regards to this Australian, Peter Ramster, what made his work, as far as you're concerned, that important?
Well, what Ramster did, he decided that he had two or three female regression subjects that had been coming up with some very interesting information about past lives, all of which were based in Europe. And none of these women had ever been outside. They were Australian women, and they'd never been outside of Australia, or certainly not been to Europe. So he's an extraordinary man, Ramster, and his interest was piqued, and he thought, well, you know, now this is something that really would be quite impressive if we could verify any of this information they're coming up with over here by taking them over to Europe. And what was extremely lucky for us all with Ramster is that his lifelong passion, apart from this, has also been making films and documentaries. So he put his own documentary crew together and brought three of these best subjects over to Europe back in the 70s, basically to see if the detailed memories they'd had back in Australia matched the facts on the ground when they got over to Europe. And there's two cases in particular that I emphasize in the Little Book of the Soul. One of them involves a lady called Cynthia Henderson, who had recalled the life of a girl called Amélie de Chaville, a young French girl in late 18th century France. And she had remembered in France, back in Australia, she'd remembered being brought up in a quite impressive-sized chateau in Normandy, just outside the market town of Flers in Normandy. And she gave quite impressive details of the nature of the house and what life was like there and what the house looked like in terms of its doors and windows and the nature of all the grounds. There was a lake in the grounds. And
so maybe she sees a painting and remembers it.
The chances of that, because this isn't a particularly well-known place.
Okay.
What they found when they got over to, when they came to France, bear in mind also that they had to find the place. You know, this had just been a painting. How on earth would she know where it was? What they did was they took her to the center of Flers, because obviously under trance back in Australia, she had recalled that it used to take them about an hour by horse-drawn coach to get into the center of Flers from the chateau. So they took her to the marketplace in Flers, and they said, okay, we'll try and find your way back out again to the chateau. And back in Australia, under trance, she'd mentioned a rough idea of the direction. She said it used to go north out of the town, hit the main road, I think going to Rouen, I think it was, turn right there, you go up a long hill, you got to the top of the hill, there's a lot of woods on the left, you drop down after that, and you took a turning off to the left, and it was down through there. And indeed, they came out, and none of them had ever been to France before. They didn't know this area at all. And there they were, just going on the word of a woman, you know, who said she'd lived there several hundred years before. And the journey out of Flers was pretty much as she described it. They dropped down this hill, took a left off the road, went through the forest. They then got to a new development. Of course, things have obviously changed in 200 years, and they got to a new development, and they couldn't find their way through it properly. And they thought, well, this is it. And she was struggling to work out what to do, but they managed to find their way around this new development and got to the other side, and she felt that she was back on track again. And they came around a corner, and they saw this long wall, and she said, I'm absolutely sure this is it. I think we're getting close. She was very, very emotional, obviously, by this stage, because, you know, this had been building up for some time. And, you know, these people, they have these memories, and they're kind of, they think they're real, but when it actually then gets proved to be real on the ground, it's a totally different thing. And they went up, and there was the chateau exactly as she described it, but it had sustained a lot of bomb damage in the war. So it wasn't inhabited anymore. It wasn't a well-known place particularly. And it looked exactly as she'd described it back in Australia. The grounds were the same, the lake was there, the particular doors and the turret that she described at the back were all exactly as she'd described them. And, you know, she broke down, understandably. You know, she was just so fascinated to realize that those memories were real. But there were two other things that are probably even more impressive on this case. First of all, she said that they regularly used to go to a holiday home near Mont Saint-Michel on the coast to the west. And they went there, and again, she led them around lots of little back roads on the coast until they found this place, which was, again, as she described it was a private house, and it had a chapel in the grounds. And she said the chapel had a quite an unusual hexagonal stone font, and it had bluey-gray slate tiles on the floor in the chapel. And again, they managed to gain access to this private little chapel. You know, it's a private place, not open to the public as far as I know. You know, not well known again. And there was the hexagonal stone font and the blue and gray tiles on the floor, again, exactly as she described them.
That's incredible.
But what's even more incredible then, the final twist on this Cynthia Henderson story, is that back in Flers, they got a young local man, obviously a fluent French speaker, to sit there, and Ramster put Cynthia into trance, and then he tried to get there, because he'd had a few cases before where people had spontaneously in trance started talking in other languages. In fact, what was interesting is he'd even had some people remembering ancient Egyptian lives talking in what would appear to be the language of the time, which, of course, we've never understood how the ancient Egyptians spoke. And in fact, it's a bit tantalizing because Ramster talks about wanting to follow that up back in the 70s and or early 80s. And
oh, that's, see, that's a good point because it was not Arabic at the time, was it?
Absolutely not, no. But I don't know what came of that because he had tapes of that, obviously. But anyway, so this young man managed to start conversing with Cynthia in French. And from her normal Australian accent, she went into fluent French with a perfect French accent, often archaic, using archaic terms that aren't used anymore but would have been used back several hundred years before. And sometimes he spoke in French and she answered in English. Sometimes he spoke in English and she answered in French, always going backwards and forwards. Apparently, this was not just oui or non. You know, this was detailed conversations where it was absolutely clear that she understood exactly what he was saying to her. And this went on for some time, and the young man himself was absolutely gobsmacked by the way she was able to speak French in trance in the way that she did. And, of course, the next morning they went into the market in Flair, and Ramster makes the point, you know, there she was again, you know, trying to make herself understood with pidgin English and lots of gesticulation, just like the rest of them. You know, and they established she had had probably, I gather, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months of some very basic French tuition when she was 12 years old, and that was it. And there she was speaking perfectly fluent archaic French. Now, Ramster's cases aren't very well known, unfortunately, outside of Australia. But I'm doing the very best I can to resurrect them and make them better known because they are absolutely fantastic.
Why do you think that his cases, and he in particular, aren't being splattered all over the place?
Well, I don't know. I think it's just one of those things that sometimes this incredible work just gets lost, especially if it isn't, you know, it didn't come either out of the UK or the US. But as I said, I mean, you see, the documentary that Ramster put together was shown. I know it was shown once on terrestrial television, because that's all they had then, back in the, I believe, in the late 70s or early 80s, certainly in this country. It may well have been shown over there in the States. But it was just shown once, and I've met a couple of people who have seen it, and they confirm everything that I talk about and that's in Ramster's book, and they said it was absolutely incredible. And in fact, I've been in touch with Peter Ramster in Australia for some time now, and what I would like to do is to try and persuade him that we can re-release this stuff on DVD, because I think people would find it absolutely fascinating now. But unfortunately, he's had a personal tragedy about a year ago, and from what I can tell at the moment, he and his wife have sort of gone into the outback for a period of seclusion, so he's not been contactable for about a year. So I'm hoping that A, that he's okay, but B, that the universe will decide this is an important thing to release again at some point.
Jeez. Ian, we're approaching the top of the hour here, so yeah. We'll be back in just a moment, but any evidence out there that shows us that ancient texts, paintings on walls, that they believed in the afterlife and reincarnation? I assume so. We know about the Egyptians, obviously.
Yes, although, funny enough, you know, the Egyptians, there's no strong evidence to suggest that the Egyptians did believe in reincarnation. And in fact, the same is true of the Mesopotamians. You know, it's only when you get around to, well, it's not really even in the Vedas either. A lot of scholars would suggest that, you know, the early Vedic religion, which is the earliest probably of the whole lot, and it's obviously...
Hold on, Ian. We'll be right back. We're right back on Coast to Coast AM.